I tend to go and see all my family beforehand because Ooh. Trying to travel on Christmas yeah. week with the UK trains being what they are in across all sorts of years, not even factoring in the strikes at the moment. It's not a good idea. So I
yeah.
And you're talking to a crowd of people who know exactly what it's like to have a very robust rail system that's not functioning at 100%. And we're all we've all had that frustration.
I didn't know how much you'd be able to empathize with that one. Sure. But yeah.
Buddy, I get it. I get it.
God, anybody else hate when their gold bathtub, their solid gold bathtub, just isn't as shiny as it?
Oh, I am absolutely a living example of first world problems. Trust me.
Yeah, Americans take note that we can't partake in first world problems. We start in the sky, a ship hovering above a large, rolling, verdant expanse. Far beneath them, vanishingly far beneath the Uhuru, is a forest. Every forest, the Queen's infinite forest. We can see the wind passing through the trees, a frothing rage of branches threatening the ship above with the ground below. The Uhuru is climbing, higher, higher than the clouds, higher than where most ships would travel, looking for where the forest ends. The Queen has the ability to make her forest and those who are inside it stretch on to wander forever. But the Queen does not own the sky. And so long as the Uhuru has fuel to burn, they should be able to rise above and find an escape. Out of immediate danger, the crew of the Uhuru is left with a short, intense period where they must think through the adventure that they have just gone on. Before they have a vision of the future that they are headed towards, they must contemplate their past and their present.
I was just going to ask, what time of day is it? Or what time?
I believe we just transitioned, and I can't remember if we... we transitioned out of night. So this is like early morning.
Okay. I think Jonnet is at the front of the ship. I think he's like on the deck, like... Right where he would be if he was going to jump off to like the fractured statue at the front. But I think he's just kind of like, there are no stars out to speak of right now. So he's just kind of like, what's the point? And so like he's just kind of like looking out over this like wide expanse of trees. And I think you see him like take out his map. I feel like this would be one of those things where it's like, this doesn't really register on his map. He doesn't exactly know exactly where he is. And so it feels a little futile. And he's just going to like take out his map, look out, look left, look right. Nothing is ringing a bell. And he's just like kind of a little frustratedly just like crumples up, bunches up the map and kind of stuffs it in his bag again.
There are probably a few questions that Jonnet might have as he is trying to contemplate place. There is the question of Acheron itself. Mm-hmm. At this point, we don't know if the town and indeed community were simply swallowed by the forest and might be lost within. That raises the specific question of Jonnet's father and sister who were with him.
So is there any kind of like, are there stories of this forest and like the scale of like what is the largest thing to have disappeared into the forest, the Queen's Forest?
Oh.
That we could know of, that John would know of.
That's a great question. And I think the best way to answer it is going to be drawing a luminary.
A luminary. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it going to be sad that we're not going to get the changeling anymore now that Johnny's gone?
I'm truly prepared for the changeling and the forest queen to simply somehow never again show up on the show.
every time you draw it, it just bursts into flames.
Johnny texts you. What are you doing?
What's up?
Hey, my butt itches. Are you guys drawing luminaries?
There he is. Yeah. There's our special boy.
It has to happen.
His butthole is itching.
Meaning that we have drawn the changeling. Good, good.
Our yearning, special boy.
Impulse, will, and transformation. Like at this point, it is both historical fact and also like legend, because this happened probably around 180, 190 years ago, but there was a city that sat like right next to a forest, like a big metropolis, one of the largest population centers that managed to survive the initial starfall. And, you know, like 10 to 20 years after the stars fell, it was swallowed in its entirety by the forest. There are a lot of conflicting accounts about exactly what happened. You know, some say people made a bad deal with the queen. Some say people like incurred her wrath. Some say it was completely unprovoked and like the forest, like almost like a tsunami, welled up and just crashed over the walls of this city. Regardless, the result is this city is off the map. People used to, you know, probably visit this place on Griffinback because this is before there were the skyships that you use today. Like, it was still a factor. There were people living in it, people probably surviving in part off of what they get from that forest, and suddenly gone. And Jonnet, I feel like this is just, you know, one of the stories that Hip has told you, and that is a particularly galling and draining thing on your mind now, because you know this story and you can scarcely say how you know it. You remember the information, but you don't remember hearing how the information was told to you, and that leads you to know exactly where the information came from.
Yeah, and so I think the scrunching of the map, yeah, definitely has much more like desperation to it, and so yeah, he's gonna like crumple up the map, he's gonna put it in his bag, and then like he's just kind of gonna pace. He's pacing. I would say that like he jumps up on the railing on the deck, and it's just kind of like pacing up and down the front of the ship. Just kind of like looking for anything, because he's pacing around trying to keep the thought of this is Hearth all over again. This is Hearth. Acheron's the new Hearth out of his head, and like he's not doing a good job. And so maybe he like I feel like there's got to be someone in the crew that keeps like some kind of telescope on them that's maybe not the captain. And I feel like maybe he's gonna like, he's gonna pace a little bit, and then he's gonna think of them, and like, maybe like go below deck, and like maybe try to either ask for or just like borrow their like telescope to try and wayfind a little bit.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea. So there are two options for you. There's mm-hmm. one whomever is in the crow's nest right now, or as you said, somebody below deck, like within the belly of the ship, who like watches the world from there. Which do you prefer?
I think it's like, it's definitely crow's nest, and I think Jonnet is going to, he's going to stop pacing, he's going to look up at the crow's nest, and he's going to start climbing, and then he's going to get to the top, and he's very much more like short than another version of Jonnet. Just going to essentially ask for the room. He's like, I got the watch here. I've got the watch. You can get out of here.
Sure thing.
Yeah, thanks.
Are you sure you're going to be all right?
Yeah, and then he just like holds out his hand and is like, eh.
Oh, there's a moment of hesitation. Yeah, whatever you need. Gives you the telescope.
Nathan, and so, it sounds like this person is younger than Jonnet, which makes me think this is one of the sickly orphans that we have aboard the ship. Which means the question that I have for you, like, I think this person is maybe a year younger than Jonnet. But obviously, Jonnet has been through all of these adventures. Jonnet has been in the thick of, like, some of the most dangerous things the Uhuru has experienced over the last several months. So I want to know, how is this person, who is essentially Jonnet's age, looking at Jonnet right now as he's like just kind of come up, requested their duty, relieved them of duty, and like sent them off?
So this orphan, now orphan, Gwen, I think, she, because we have the whole process of they get to decide whether they stay on board and continue to help. So she is pretty privy to the recent series of events, and there has now been almost an immediate snapshot of Jonnet in his birthday Sunday best, beaming, having finally become a man. And from our perspective, not even really 24 hours later, this hollow and horribly shaken version of the exact same person. I think every person that she knows on the ship has had this moment of going from pride to despair in such a short period of time. And even she, I suppose. So she understands, but isn't really in a position to pry on exactly what horrors Jonnet has seen. So she's just very, you know, if you need anything, please do say. We're all here to help if you need it.
I'm good, thank you.
Yes, of course.
Go ahead.
And so I think from there, he takes the telescope. He like starts to put it up, and then he just like kind of surveys the areas. Like, there is nothing that is discernible. Like, and I think his shoulders are very heavy and very tight, and he's just like, he sighs at the futility of what he's about to do, and then he puts the telescope up and starts like looking around.
All right, we'll cut from there. I do just want to point out how much I love that Jonnet had his 16th birthday, and like snapping our fingers, we're on his moody teen arc, which
that's what happens.
Love that more if I tried.
The moment you get into freshman year, it hits real, real hard.
It comes for everyone.
Yeah. Exact same time.
Next. Oh God, I am really debating whether we need to move to Gable or Orimar next. Like, everybody's carrying some heavy, heavy weight.
I was going to say, for me, I think Gable's making their way to Orimar anyway.
Okay. So then we will do Orimar next, because Gable will come to bring the threads together.
Okay. So Orimar is in the kind of like bathrooms. He's sitting in a bath. Orimar, while dead, has had to clean himself times before. He doesn't sweat, but just the nature of having to be out in the world means the body needs maintenance. But this is an actual bath that he has not had in 6 months. The actual, the muscle memory of making it is still there, but the sensation of sitting in a pool of warm water is intolerable. It feels awful. The sensation across his skin and actually processing the idea of heat and moisture is miserable now.
I think like Orimar has so much in common with like some of our autistic listeners right now, in that he feels all of his clothes on his body. He feels every nerve ending that is in contact with this warm water. For so long, he has not had these physical experiences, and now suddenly it's on all the time and everywhere.
And it's taking, I think he's actually having to use the processes that he does in combat to be able to block out extraneous information, to be able to focus on the task at hand. So just taking this bath has put him in fight mode, essentially, just to stop him from bodily getting back out of the bath again and being like, I can't take this. This is awful.
So
I hate
tense.
This.
The opposite of what you wanted to bet.
I know. Mm-hmm. He's surrounded by bubbles. Just
yeah. I do want to set the scene a little bit here, because I am so intrigued by there being baths aboard the Uhuru. But the more that I think about it, the more it makes sense to me, because we have, like, as part of all skyships, furnaces. Like, those are there are, you know, 3 to 4 furnaces on this ship. So there is the luxury of being able to heat water. And we know from Bathroom Barry that there are beautiful bathroom stalls aboard the Uhuru. And I think in similar, like, grand fashion, there are these baths. So I feel like we see, like, either brass or copper, like, piping that feeds, like, this large tub. And maybe, like, there are rows of tubs in the same way there were rows of, like, actual bathroom stalls in this separate place. But I gotta feel like it is similarly opulently decorated.
Yes.
I would very
lots,
much
lots
like...
of lacquered paneled wood, I think. It has a very alpine kind of feel. You know, to make the baths marble too would just be too ostentatious, even for Bathroom Barry.
It's so heavy.
Yes.
Yes.
Bathroom Barry is just like, there's a lot you can accomplish with a good stain and some lacquer. You don't need to go overboard.
Very DIY.
But yeah, you know, or what would be a moment of like relaxation and centering, just has kind of continued this entirely new hurdle for Orimar to have to cope with and deal with. At the time, Travis may have thought that the captain being alive again would be a blessing, but at the moment where things currently are, Orimar can only see it as a curse. Eventually, the sensation is just too much, and he's like, this is fine. And gets back out and changes back into kind of like clothes to make his way to his office. Because he needs to reseed his dreads, which is also something that has not been done properly in the last 6 months.
Not since Dref died.
6 months, that's so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's having some physical trouble with it. There's also muscle memory here. He knows how to do this. But the way that he was able to pilot his body before, while still nuanced, was in very broad strokes. And this is something that requires such fine dexterity. He hasn't tried writing anything yet. He almost doesn't dare. But this process is, even though he knows what to do, is taking him too long. And whenever the narrative resumes with other people, he's in the middle of doing so, if interrupted.
Yeah. I think like one thing that I would like to clarify with this is it's probably because Orimar is caught between controlling his body in the natural, instinctual way that all of us as living beings control our own bodies, mm-hmm. and controlling his body as a necromantic thing. Mm. He used to have to think about literally everything he did, at least in some way. I mean, a good analogy for anybody who lives in our world is a video game where you input every movement deliberately that you do instead of doing all of it instinctually, even if some of it is wrapped up in muscle memory. That used to be how Orimar had to just live his life. Now he is back in a body, and probably his mind and spirit are fighting over that a little bit.
Yeah, I was gonna ask. Orimar tries to look inward. I'm not somebody who's tried meditating, and I don't think I would necessarily be capable of it. My mind is too fried. But he tries to look inwards at his own soul, which I don't think is something a person normally knows how to do. But, you know, he's previously aware of the physicality of his own soul and tries to do so now. Is that even possible?
Well, I have just drawn the children, also known as the angels, which represent consequence, inevitability, and eternity. And I kind of think, based on the experiences that Orimar has had, and this being so recent after coming back into his physical body, mm-hmm. I feel like you are walking along and then suddenly, very quickly, you find yourself pulled back into your mind palace. Like, the world is so loud. There is so much experience, like so many physical sensations, and also what you are weighing on your mind, the conversations that you had with the queen, your plans for the future, your feelings for the people who are so close to you in your life, what the Greenhearts taunted you with, the idea that perhaps you have been walking down this path so resolutely you have been willing to burn the things that are actually most important to you. All of that swirling torment, trying to turn it off, and suddenly you are in the mind palace once more.
It feels a little different now that the body has its own functions back. It's actually almost as if rather than sitting in this giant manor held up with a million spider strings, it now feels more like sitting on a train late at night going somewhere else. You stare out the window, and through the murky glass you can kind of see the rest of the world continue to move inevitably in a direction, but you don't actually have control over that here. You're not the conductor driving this train. Another force is doing so. It's still you, technically, moving this train along and its destination, but you're not moving it from here. Not anymore.
Yeah. What I am curious about, but I want to define a few things now, because I think this is a unique meditative state that probably only Orimar Vail and arguably Dref are the two people in history who have ever been able to achieve an awareness of their own soul and the separation between their soul and their body, and enter a place like retreat into their souls. So I want to know a little bit about it. The first is, are you still experiencing the outside world as you're looking through this window? Like, are you just kind of faintly feeling feelings and physical sensations, or are they separated from you?
I think I previously kind of described the sensations that were coming in when Orimar was dead was essentially data. Mm-hmm. And looking at it from this perspective, it still becomes data again. Like, we're looking at this in a series of pressures and sensors. But there is context now that was a whole bunch of arbitrary information that Orimar had to learn to process and re-understand. There is actually now context for what we're seeing and feeling, and that is now there. But it's almost as if there is now a layer of what that information means on top of it. if Oromar was in a better headspace, he may even consider this useful. Right now, it is just frustrating.
The next question that I have is, Oromar and Dref basically established controls, these strings or webs that they used to operate Oromar's body as though they were programming a machine. Mm-hmm. Do these controls still exist within this space, or when you re-entered the living world, did they kind of evaporate?
I wonder what it feels for somebody who is a marionetteer when the puppet starts moving on its own, but you're still holding the crossbars. And we will leave it at that.
If we know anything from Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, horrifying and chaotic. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That little wooden boy. So much trouble.
But that's the point. You can't. You get the little boys you get, and you don't try to make them other little boys. That's the lesson.
Well, that, and a little boy is only a little boy if it can die.
Yes.
If it can't die, it's not a little boy.
Not a little boy anymore.
That's the most important thing about being a real person, is the ability to die, according to that film.
That very makes fun. That very complicated for most of this cast, but okay.
Yeah, I think this show explicitly disagrees with Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
But yes, I think the spider strings are moving on their own because the subconscious that's making this body move through instinct is helping this body walk down the corridor of the Uhuru to the captain's quarters without banging into any walls or any people. And the body's just doing that.
So the body is still moving. That's interesting. That's a really, really fascinating thing to be aware of now in Oromar's skill set, is his body can now move, like, partially because of the systems that were established by both Oromar and Dref, without consciousness within it at all, which I think there are a lot of interesting and, like, exploitable things about that. Oromar's body might be able to fight, like, completely separately from Oromar's soul now, based on that idea, which I think is really, really cool.
Yes, although Oromar's body cannot take this kind of damage that Oromar's body used to be able to.
Absolutely, absolutely. Nobody's questioning that, but I am just fascinated at, like, a point where maybe your ghost jumps out of your body and, like, flanks the person that you're fighting with ghost swords. Really cool stuff. The last question that I have is, we knew previously that Oromar had come to be able to see and interact with his body more like a tool, device, or machine than a part of himself, to the point that he actually remolded his flesh and bone to become weapons. My question to you, Nathan, is that potential still there?
Oh.
Knock, knock. Who's there?
Spoiler bottle of that, please.
Oh, gosh, I love that. Oromar is kind of struck with all of this as his body continues to navigate down the halls. And we can see there are crew members, like, who move around Oromar. This is the captain, you know, striding from the baths back to the captain's quarters. And there are plenty of crew members that he passes. And really, everyone is kind of going through their own stuff right now. We have all been through a harrowing experience. Despite that, the way Oromar goes through stuff, the way Oromar moves through life, he is experiencing things on a scale that people can only make sense of by narrativizing. Oromar is a figure, as a living person, who only makes sense as the hero of a truly fantastic story. Everybody on this crew knows that, really, until a few hours ago, Oromar Vale was dead. And now, their captain is not just the man who cheated death. Orimar is inarguably the man who has conquered death. He was struck down, he lived as a dead thing, and now he lives again.
And he's absolutely miserable for it.
But they don't see that, especially as you have retreated into yourself. What they see is Orimar's reflexes, Orimar's default modes of operating, and they just see someone resolutely and confidently walking down a hallway, if silently. And I think, Orimar, you can feel the weight of your presence move through the ship, the way a ship on the sea can feel the wake of its presence move through the ocean. You cut aside the crowds, and people look at you in awe, respect, and fear.
And yet the captain says nothing, too caught up in his own thoughts. And before long, he reaches the door to his office. And it's the sound of the door closing behind him that I think jolts him out of looking internally. The body has now arrived at its destination, a light here for the captain's office.
Then let's cut over to Gable.
Gable, how long has it been since Travis left?
I think hours at this
point. Just a few hours. Gable has not in like the sleeping quarters or anything. They are below deck in a particularly dusty corner, and they're sort of just sitting on the floor thinking, and you can see in the dust on the floor there's a bunch of like patterns and markings that they've drawn out. And what they've been trying to do ever since Travis left is try really hard to remember all the stars that they saw in the sky last night. Because as soon as Travis left, they started freaking out about, I've seen the same constellations for hundreds of years. I know exactly what's in the sky. And in sort of like an anxious, obsessive sort of way, they're double, triple checking, like, is this here? Is this here? Was this here before? Was this here before? So they're just desperately mapping through, but can't hang on to the memory that well. And so they're just sort of stewing.
Yeah, I think, like, the thing is, Gable, we know, is not a star watcher, has never studied star watching, and kind of always had this awareness that, like, I mean, maybe I don't know how long they've had this particular awareness. They must have known that they were a fallen, like, and they had a vague idea that, like, well, stars are angels. And, you know, there's two things that you carried around with you. Those are lights in the sky that move around. And those things, like, some of them are like Fred. Like, theoretically, I knew that specific guy.
This is my friend. My friend used to be in the top right corner. Mm-hmm. Is my friend still there?
Yeah. So, like, you, like, it used to be, like, information that you knew, but, like, was not ever as important as your immediate life. As, well, I have to, you know, survive or stay secret until the next day, and then I'll think about the day after that. Or there are simply too many injustices in this world, and I have to focus on correcting what I can because I both feel compelled to do that and feel that that is the right thing to do. But now, like, you are looking at the fact that there are stars in the sky through a completely different lens. Those lights that have been above you for 200 years. Like, I feel like in Gable's mindscape, we can see those things getting closer and closer and closer, and the light that is emanating from them resolves to become more complicated with patterns and textures until it is very clear that they are eyes looking down on the world of sphere, emanating light from them, and that each point of light in the sky is its own being, and one of them that sits resolutely above all the others and does not move is the morning star, Lucifer. Hey heroes, it's James, your game master, and welcome to the mid-roll. Heroes, we are so glad to be back with Mainline Campaign. We hope you missed us. Skyjoust will be resuming on its own feed soon. There are a few technical things we need to square away since we found that error, but be sure to watch our mid-rolls and our mailing list for news of when it launches. A reminder that the One Shot Podcast Network is going to be at Gen Con again this year, and that part of that will be the Skyjacks live show, Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Crown Plaza Haymarket A. We have confirmed that Nathan Blades is going to be at that show, and we're still seeing who else in the cast we're going to be able to get out with us, but I can promise you that it's going to be a great show. If you're going to Gen Con, I suggest you sign up for this show as quickly as possible. We have sold out in the past, and I don't want anyone to miss it. A huge thank you to all of our supporters on Patreon. Without you, we would not be able to make this show. We're still working on our budget for next year based on the Patreon drive. However, this month we are also working to roll out the new rewards that we have for the show. So be sure to watch your Patreon feed for updates about that. Now then, a quick word from our sponsor. And with all that out of the way, let's get back in the sky!
You may not know this. Can you tell me if there were more stars in the sky last night?
Yes. So there are, generally speaking, 13 stars in the sky, including the morning star. So there are 12 stars, and the 13th is the morning star.
But that's always been the case.
That's usually the case. If Gable paid more attention, Gable would know. Sometimes you don't see all 13 stars in the sky. Mm-hmm. And like part of it might be where you are in sphere. But like this is data that like Jonnet probably knows is hotly contested between different star watchers, because one star watcher will debate that it is a particular star in the sky, or, you know, I think classically through different star watching traditions, each of the stars is named, and, you know, they'll be like, Polaris was in the sky last night had Polaris, the morning star, Omicron, and Nebula. Like those were the four stars that we were able to see. And people will be like, no, it wasn't that. It was Raphael, Polaris, and Nebula that were in the sky with the morning star. And so some nights we'll have all stars burning bright. Some nights we'll have a few visible, a few partially visible, and star watchers will squabble and argue over which ones were which ones were visible, which ones were invisible. And if Gable has picked up any of that, they will know sometimes the stars are in the sky, and sometimes those angels are doing other things. What are they doing when they're doing other things? What is happening? How does heaven work now that the throne is empty?
Is there ever a moment where it's like, holy shit, there's a 14th star? Like, has anyone ever looked up and seen that? Or is it very consistent, like, it's either...
Well, I got to draw a luminary for that, Tyler. You know, fair. I got to draw a luminary for that.
Fair.
And I love how much of the cosmology of this whole show depends on this one luminary pole right here.
Entire moons die. Is it the boy? Is it our sweet boy?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. The Star Watcher!
A bit on the nose.
Just a sketch. A little bit.
All right, let's see. What are the themes here? guidance, wisdom, and clarity. Yes, Tyler. Yes, there are moments that are recorded in your star watching manuals that we'll have to determine exactly how careful a study Jonnet has been to the history of this practice and the actual, like, skill of this practice. But there are shooting stars, and star watchers hotly debate what a shooting star is. And I think there are times there are like phantom stars, flickers of stars that will appear in the sky or maybe be in a sky and burn out over the course of a night or appear for a few seconds and then disappear. That's what that result suggests to me. So they are extremely rare. They are recorded and debated between different star watching traditions and different star watchers. Probably there is no end to the list of theories of what is going on. An important thing to think of is most star watchers are not thinking of the stars as the sovereign's angels. They're just seeing them as the lights in the sky that guide their divination practices or their navigation practices that tell them information about the world of sphere.
Knowing what they do now, Gable is sort of just standing up with their hands leaning and pressed on like a low-hanging beam, just completely in a spiral, in an anxiety spiral. Just that knowing and unsurety of, like, sometimes the 13th's not there, so the going in and out, and who was there last night, who could potentially be down on Earth now, is just completely annihilating their both sense of self and their sense of comfort. And so they need to find something to get them out of. They need to tell someone or stop this thought process as soon as they can.
Yeah. And for stage picture, I think one thing that we need to point out is that Gable is doing this contemplation in the area of the ship where they were keeping their rock collection. That's what it feels like. This is where they did that ceremony earlier that, like, kind of knocked them out as they touched the feather and retreated into their memories and recalled their history with the Morning Star. And things swirling around you is like, yeah, who is left? Who is gone? And we can see, like, kind of a bird's eye view of Gable in this space where they have charted out, like, trying to figure out what the constellations were last night. They have, like, drawn pictures of these various stars, and you are currently surrounded by them. And probably right at your feet is whatever picture you have drawn to represent the Morning Star, which I am so curious, Liz, what that looks like, how Gable has drawn that thing.
Oh, boy. It's probably a little half-hearted, a little bit dusty, but it's a mouth with a tongue.
Ooh, I like how creepy that is. And like sort of spanning out from that, swirling around that, are these depictions of the other 12 stars that could exist, that are known to be in the sky. And I think Gable is hit with a feeling that, like, I and Liz, you can tell me whether or not this is true. I have to imagine that, especially now, within the past year of their life, Gable has looked back at the last 200 years as wasted time a little bit. As like, I have not been learning as much as I wish I knew right now.
Oh yeah, there's a tremendous amount of regret. And I feel like Travis sort of did the same thing, where so much of their time was spent hiding, being afraid, and just attempting to just exist with the knowledge that existence was forever and pointless. And I think they feel a little bit of regret, but also melancholy at no longer having that time in their life anymore, because the moment that they started caring about things is the moment where they the things started to get hard. And like, when you open yourself up to the realities of who you were as a person in the past, you can either move on and say like, okay, I'm just going to do better. I'm going to be better. Or you can just stick and be constantly beating yourself up. Like, I hate the person who I was. I regret everything. And they're not there yet. They're still very much like, I don't know how to be better yet.
And I think all of that coming to a head is exactly as you pointed out earlier. You need something to switch it off, to focus it away. And I feel like you'll... That this is where you're heading to the captain's office. I just want to know, what is it like for Gable moving through, you know, the halls of the Uhuru to get to the captain's quarters?
Well, first they sweep their boot over all the dust to hide the map they're making. And then I think they're kind of in the bowels of the ship, so they're making their way up stairs and trying to clock as many people as they can and how everyone's feeling after this truly exhausting moment in the woods. But also, most of us don't know what happened to the rest of the crew and what they went through.
I am going to draw a luminary for the crew of the Uhuru right now, because I can see morale landing in a lot of different directions right now.
Most of those directions being low.
Yeah.
Or they're like, yeah, hell yeah, we did it.
This could be, yeah, we've, yet again, the Uhuru has survived against impossible odds, you know.
You can only do that so many times.
Yeah, the loom. The loom is toil, obligation, and sacrifice. So I kind of think the overall feeling that the crew has right now is tired. The core of the loom truly is sacrifice for a thing that you love. And the question that I had more than anything else is, how did they view the fact that all of the loss that they suffered was probably for Travis? You know, like, people died, people suffered. Like, we only know what horrors were experienced by a few members of the crew and, you know, the captain's council, but everybody was in those woods. Everybody could have encountered Greenhearts. Everybody could have had the deepest fears within their hearts and their minds read for them and played out for them in like a sickening puppet show controlled by the Forest Queen herself. And I think what we're learning here from the loom is this is how the crew of the Uhuru behaves. When somebody in their number is in trouble, they work to help that person, even if it costs them things. And although that they signed up to do that, and like it is idealistically like the thing that they are committed to, it's also a really hard thing to do. So it's a victory, but it's a hard won victory. There are no revels. There is no celebration. There is the solemn nod of people who are doing their duty. And they are now, after that duty, breathing, but breathing with tension, as currently the ship is still trying to escape the grasp of the Forest Queen. And especially right now, that means climbing to higher and higher altitudes. It is getting colder, and the air is getting thinner.
So Gable's very single-minded, and I think they come up to the captain's door pretty quickly. I don't remember. How much do we know about the captain right now? So the whole crew knows that he's alive now?
Yeah. I think especially because the whole crew knew that he was dead. Seeing like there's one thing of like seeing Orimar as Dreff's magnificent like a trick played on everybody, being like a very convincing, like, you know, animatronic that uses a real human body versus seeing a living and breathing man. And I think because everybody had that knowledge, it might be obvious to most of them, or at least those who have the keenest eyes, that, yeah, the captain's alive now. And I think to Gable, probably, with your angel stuff, I think you can
I think you can tell, definitely. Gotcha. But actually, I'll leave that. You know what? I'm going to leave that to Nathan. Nathan, how many people know that you're alive?
I like the idea of when Oromar was moving down the corridor to his office and they were passing by people and not responding to them. There may have been a couple of people who encountered the captain on that walk and just kind of noticed that his skin was not as ashen as before. Mm. You know, the way that you can visibly tell if someone is a corpse or not.
It's like, ooh, that's not a dead person.
I feel like that probably, like, that spawns, like, a chain of thought in maybe, like, probably more than half of the crew where it's like, oh, my God, that means he was, wow, I didn't see that for six months. Whoa. Wait, am I stupid?
Yeah, I guess in a certain way, especially since he's definitely not wearing his hat. He used to wear his hat a lot specifically to obscure his face and make it harder to tell. And walking through this hatless and I guess to some people's eyes carefree of that space, I suppose he looks like an entirely different person, the way his body has carried himself. I guess literally and metaphorically under this circumstance was not as how he behaved before.
So I think Gable has some idea at this point because we had that talk with Travis on the deck, but not knowing exactly what. So before they knock on the captain's door, they pick out an orphan who they know is going to the kitchen and bend down and say, hi, what's your name?
It's Gwen.
Gwen. Oh, Gwen, I'm so sorry. I didn't remember. That's completely on me.
It's fine. You've been busy. We've all been busy.
I know. Well, we've all been busy, and you've been very brave.
She looks
from what
haunted
I can gather.
When she says busy. One considers what she kind of ran into in the forest for a while.
And seeing that thousand-yard stare, I'm going to make this. Hey, I have a quick question for you. The captain might need some things. I was wondering if you could go to the kitchen and get us a water skin and a bowl of fruit, potentially. And while you're there, I want you to get anything that you might have and put it on my, you know, my tab. I'm sure we have tabs, right?
There is a pause as she considers what options that might be. Am I allowed to get some chocolate, Gable?
Of course you're allowed to get chocolate. Any chocolate that you might like.
There is a very thin smile, but she's genuinely pleased. Right away. I'll knock before entering. But...
Please. Thank you so much. And Gwen, committing it to memory, your face is Gwen. Gwen.
She has... Gwen. I'm picturing Gwen. For some strange, she has quite light hair and a very dark kind of Alice band that's holding the hair back. Right away. Hopefully the captain's okay.
Yes, that hey, the captain is as okay as any of us. So
that makes sense. That makes sense. Right. So then we're definitely going to need chocolate then. And she turns heel and. Like, patters away down the corridor.
Great.
Excellent. And Gable heads towards the captain's quarters then. I would like to cut back to Jonnet. Tyler, there's one thing that I thought about, and I do want us to remember it as one of Jonnet's abilities, and is probably, like, one of the only things that you might be able to do now, faced with all of the stuff that you were thinking through. And that is, Jonnet recently unlocked the ability of texting, which is he can write a message on a feather and send that feather to a person. So I feel like, as you like look through the forest and like you can tell me if you want to actually be looking for something and we can probably like draw a luminary for that or whatever, but like, you could also probably get a message to your sister or your father or your mother or what have you. I just want us to remember that Jonnet has this ability before you do something and then go to join Gable and the captain.
I feel like, yeah, I think he is looking for, because in my head, we are hovering over like just a unrelenting like sea of trees. And I think Jonnet is looking for anything that could be like interpreted as a landmark, or as like a break in the trees, best case scenario, the tree line stops far off in the distance and it's like, oh, there, that's where we go. Anything other than just like dense, unending, unrelenting trees of more or less the similar height.
Right. Well, for that, we got to draw Luminary.
Fair.
For sure. Okay. And for that, we get the whale. The whale, or the Leviathan, stands for revenge, irony, and fate. I don't know about you, but to me, that suggests there's no variation.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah,
that's the thing that's infuriating. This is completely impenetrable. This is the power of a luminary.
I think that's like, if to someone who hasn't been like watching the trees for as long as Jonnet has, it's like you wouldn't even think about it. It's like, okay, it's a lot of trees. We're in the domain of the Forest Queen. Like, okay, like something's going on. But it's like the more time you spend with it, the more you realize like these trees are damn near the exact same height. Like, there's no way that like these could all have been planted and germinated and grown exactly at the same time. But it's like, it's almost like level. Like, what yeah. the, like, this is, the more you notice it, the more maddening it becomes. And so then I think there's a moment where it's like, where just out of frustration, he collapses the telescope and then maybe just like squats in the, like takes a seat in the crow's nest and he goes to like put the telescope in his bag, and then that's when he realizes like feather. Oh my god, the feather. He immediately like springs into action. Oh my god. He like pats himself down for like, you know, some kind of writing utensil, and he's got like some ink, and like he's got like a sphere equivalent of like a paperclip. It's not like a proper pen, but it's enough to dip the ink into and like scroll. So I think he writes out, oh man.
I feel like it's old school texting rules. It's like 140 characters or something like that.
Hella abbreviated, which means to me, that means like he's sending it to Zana. And so he essentially,
hi, how are you?
It's like, fine. It's truly really like, where are you at? And so like he scrolls that out and then he realizes that if he were to get this to Zana, like, he'd need to like provide some kind of like, where am I? And so he gets up and he looks around, and that's when he takes in again the just like the even, plain, flat, and it's like, I have no way of communicating where the hell I am. And so he's just like, where are you at? We are in the sky, look up. Sorry, can't be more specific, Jonnet. and so like, oh geez, did we already establish how this works? Because I assume it's just some like he's got to like either focus on Zana, he's got to like say Zana's name or something like that, and then like, and then he uses this as an opportunity to like release a little bit of frustration, because even though it's a feather, he just like cocks back and just like hurls it, and then it just like, I assume it just starts like floating. Yeah. and so I guess he kind of, it floats down, maybe like it floats down below the crow nest, so he can't even see like the magic that is within it to like get to the person. He's just like, well, I guess I've done all I can do now. And so he just like just sits back and now I think he's just like very, very not manically, but like nervously like extending and retracting the telescope. He's just trying to make the sounds just to like be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like actually like opening and closing the telescope with a tick like that, the thing about that is it is a rhythmic thing that has a very regular rhythm. Yeah. And I feel like that is the sort of thing that helps Jonnet step a little bit beyond his brain and his emotions right now to like know that he needs to clear his head, very much in the same way that Gable knew that they needed to clear their head.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I think with that, it's like it is like a, and then I think there's, you know, there's like a level of groove that like one kind of like starts to fall into, and then you look at, and then like you look and like his toe is starting to tap in a like on the ones and the threes, and so like he is like sort of like settling into this little bit of like a rhythm, and there's a, like a little bit of a rocking back and forth, and then I think with that, I guess he's gonna like, you know, try to like summon and open up his eye, because like, you know, his the mortal plane that he's on right now isn't giving him much.
Ooh, that's fascinating. I love that. Do you have an idea of a specific thing that you want to accomplish by opening your eye, or a question that you're trying to answer?
I think it is like, it's part just like, this feels a little futile, but he's still going to like keep Zana in mind. Actually, no, he sent the feather to Zana, so he's going to try to like think of Douglas. And try mm-hmm. to, like, if I were to try to plot a course, or if I needed, like, a beeline to this person, where does the divine light point me towards?
Oh, gosh, I love that. And I am drawing now. What I get is the soldiers. And the soldiers are death, deception, and memory. So
Dref?
You are
Drefception?
Drefception.
Drevery?
That's when you put Dref inside somebody's dreams instead of removing him from somebody's dreams.
Oh my, I'm inside a dream.
I had such a neurotic dream.
Stressful.
I think, like, you were trying to plot a course for them using their eye, and I think, well, using your eye, and I think what comes back to you is just how significant and powerful the influence of the Forest Queen is within her domain. Because what Jonnet gets from that eye is the way the universe works. He sees the lines that construct everything, the paths and possibilities. But like looking for the specific information within the Queen's Forest, you look down and lights abound. There are so many different places that your family could be. Mm. Like, the Queen can show you 1,000 illusions alongside the reality of where these people are.
I think this might fit in line with just like the lore that we have, because it's like the forest can kind of be everywhere.
Yeah.
And so like, so it's like, what is north, south, east, west, if you can be everywhere? So it's like, if you're trying to pinpoint, like, to go to a specific location, like if you're out of I guess a tangible like place, then where you need to be is everywhere. And so it's just like a bunch of like just firing off lights, and it's just very, it's like information overload. So, okay. So yeah, I think it's like, it's that where it's like, I didn't need more confirmation that I don't know where I am. And it's, a level of frustration with like being given so many different answers that Jonnet is just going to very like, without even thinking of like how it's going to hurt him, he just like knocks his head and just like closes his eye with like the slap on his own forehead to like shut it all up. Shut up. And so I, yeah, and then he kind of pieces it together. He's like, man, I don't even want to be in this crow's nest anymore, but I took over the shift from Gwen. So now I'm just kind of stuck up here. And like, yeah, he's stewing.
I think you can signal for a shift change, you know?
Hey, you!
Yeah?
Get up here. It's your turn.
Really? Let me go out of the crow's nest?
and then Jonathan takes stock in this person. Oh, this is like a 10-year-old.
They say I'm not supposed to go above 8 feet above the ground because I'm always falling. But
no,
I say
no,
if I
you
go
find
up-
you find someone 2 to 4 years older than you and you send them up here.
But you just said you need someone right now. You said it right now. You need to get down and
do not question a superior taller officer.
You don't know that you're taller than me. You're all the way up there. Your death perception is off.
All right. Well, then you climb up here. We'll measure each other, and then and then you go back down and you find someone to do this.
Okay. I'm climbing. And the person that you see is this extraordinarily beam pole long 10-year-old who is just super skinny, shaking like a leaf, and is so excited to be above 8 feet off the ground. I'm taller than you, and I'm ready to look out of the horizon.
You know what? Fine. Here you go, string bean. And then he like just tosses up the telescope, and then and then essentially just like slides down the ladder, just grumbling. Just tall orphans. He's tall. Why are all these orphans that we're letting on the ship getting taller? All right, back in my day, we had short orphans.
Thank you for remembering.
And we see Jonnet make his way down, like grumbling as he goes. But like, I think there is a grace to following Jonnet, who is now so familiar with every inch of this ship. He has been here a full year. And not only did he spend time as a stowaway where he had to really study and figure out how to move on a ship like very surreptitiously, but he spent time as a star watcher, as a member of the captain's council. It has become second nature for him to move. And we can see him like move down the lines and the side of the ship. And he feels very easily navigate himself to a place where he'd be able to go directly to the captain's quarters. And I think this is where we see our three together again. I think Gable gets to the captain's quarters first, and we can have a good old-fashioned knocking on the door scene. Love those.
Sky Jacks.
We return once again to the long line of applicants in front of the skyship Uhuru. Someone hobbles off the line and presents themselves to the auditioning review committee. And what does this person look like?
This person is, I would say, like very precariously standing. He's an older gentleman, very, very salt and pepper, more salt than pepper. And He's got a young man's uniform, but he's just like undersized in it, and he's very wobbly. He puts his application down. He stands back very proudly, and you can see like in his left hand, he's got like a thread of rope that he's just like, you know, just fiddling with every now and again. Like he might like, you know, do some finger work and then like pull out a knot, but then he'll undo it. And he's just fiddling with it.
Mm-hmm. There's my application.
Thank you for your application.
Thank you for steadying the ship long enough for me to get on.
Do you need a chair? Would you like to sit or perhaps
Nope, no need. Right. Tip top shape. I am just getting my sea legs here. Whoa! And then the room tilts ever so slightly, less than a degree. And Marlin, he very clumsily like scoots to the left and then rebalances himself, comes back center.
Now, if you need a chair, say you need a chair. This is a liability issue at some point. And I don't know that we can afford another slip and fall accident.
I'll have you know that I am an accomplished sailor and I do not need any kind of help.
It's also worth saying that both slip and fall were fine when they were stabbed very...
I mean, it passed right through. It didn't hit any major organs.
That's true.
But slip and fall sued the ship.
That's true. That's on us for not having the legal representation we needed. But anyway, Mr. Spike, thank you so much for giving this to us. It seems like you have an extensive experience that we would love to have on this ship.
Seafarers are kind of hard to come by, considering most of them tend not to be around these days, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Claim by time, claim by the sea, claim by cowardice, not old Marlin Spike. I am here because I noticed I was taking a walk down the dock and I saw your ship, and I looked at your ship and I saw the knot securing the ship to the dock, and I was just, well, this will not do. And so I've been retired for about 40 years, but I'm coming out of retirement now.
Excuse me. When did you retire?
What's that?
When did you retire?
About 40 years ago.
So
and
you've
I'm coming
been
out
retired
of
for 40 years?
Yes, I have. I served my crew. I served my team. We ruled the skies for a time, and I decided to hang all that up.
Anywhere from 40 to 120 years old.
Gable, you shouldn't necessarily be so concerned with people being older than expected, all things considered.
Especially because we could be sued.
Oh, wait. You don't crack either?
Y'all remember what age and discrimination sued us for?
Orimar is kind of like, well, I was previously going to be working on going the distance, but we've had people as old as 200 working on the ship, you know? No age discrimination nor accessibility discrimination, which is why you were able to get on the ship safe and sound.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, safe with an asterisk. Coming up the plank, you had the ropes that were supposed to be your essentially your guardrails as you kind of walk up. One slipped through and came untaught. I almost plummeted off of the plank into the dock, which actually cannot stand. I went and I resecured it. I did have a double Wurlitzer knot. Got in there, all good. It should be ready to go.
Now, hold on. All the knot work that we do on the ship is mostly Shibari inspired. So a lot of what we're doing is for show, but it's, you know, showmanship is important.
What? This for show? This is function, sir.
I did
what is
a
your
simple,
name?
I did a simple harness, and I finished it off with a monkey's fist.
Oh.
Who are you, and are you in a position of authority? And if so, then that is a
spit.
Scream.
Well, spit. I'm Spike, and we do not agree.
All right. That's it. It's gonna come down to a knot off between you and me.
You just said that your knots are not functional and will slip out very easily. This is a contest you are sending yourself up to lose.
My knots are loose enough for the comfort of the tie. We cannot cut off circulation.
I didn't know that that's what all of our knots were. This is so dangerous.
I'll have you know, sir, that knots need and should only be used for their functional purpose and nothing of the sexual sense or like. All right?
Yeah! How dare you?
Well, that's kind of curious, because I can kind of tell that what you're wearing, you've got some rope under there, don't you?
Absolutely. And so Spike, he reaches behind his back and then just starts, as this conversation continues, Spike is just going to be pulling out more and more rope from somewhere behind him. Yes, I accumulate rope, I collect it, and then I also weave my own, just in case I need to do some knotting, and in a way that I wasn't expecting at the beginning of the day.
Is he getting, like, thinner as he keeps on?
Yes. It's starting, like, at his ankles. Like, every time you, like, look back at him at the floor, you're noticing that, like, he's getting a little thinner, but he's not acknowledging.
Now, I know tensions are high, but there's no need to entirely unravel under current circumstances.
No, I'll have you know that I am keeping it taut, I'm keeping it tight, I'm keeping it spooled up, okay?
Okay.
I'm just preparing because it's looking like I've got my work cut out for me if all of these knots on this ship are just for show.
Oh, so you're already thinking about what you'll be doing once you're employed, I see.
You know what? That's, you have to envision yourself in the position that you want in order to achieve the position. I learned that.
Do you
that
read
when
the secret too?
Oh my God! Look,
it's canonical that everybody reads the secret.
I don't know about you and your crew, but when I finished knotting, I picked up reading, and the secret was the first on my list.
I just, the things that you can speak into existence by just putting your mind to it, mm-hmm. And I think I've put my mind to spit leaving the ship forever for a long time, and I think it's finally happening.
Well, I don't know much about this man from Adam, but from your not work, I could say that I'm available. Whatever his job is, I'm available to do it.
So you're telling me that you're available for knotting?
No, the very same.
Now this sounds much better. Okay,
Captain, I know what's happening.
I'm back on board.
No, I'm off. I'm off the board. I'm away from the board. I'm throwing the board overboard.
Look. When we hire somebody, it needs to be the end of this process. It has to be the omega of this process.
No.
And whoever we hire has to have a versatile skill set. I need an omega verse.
A separate conversation.
Out
just
of
the
this
two of us.
Process
about something else, please.
Understood.
I'm available to start tomorrow.
All right. Can you do a halter hitch?
A halter hitch? I've already got that one tied. He pulls it out from behind him.
All right. Well, what about a handcuff knot?
A handcuff? I've got handcuff links. He like pulls up his hands and he's got rope tied around securing his cuff links together.
Oh.
All right. So able to detain as well. We do handle red feathers occasionally, and we do need to make sure that they're restrained and not in a fun way, spit in a we have taken all of their stuff way.
Okay, sure, fine, but a swing hitch. Can you do a swing hitch?
A swing hitch? I haven't done that in 45 years, but if I had to guess, I'd say it has to, you go under with the loop and through and punch it in the eye and twist.
Okay.
How about that?
Okay, you got a swing hitch.
And that will support at least up to 300 pounds. 300 pounds just from this one knot.
All fine, right. Fine.
Have you
what
ever,
about? What
have
about?
You, have you ever done a sheet bend?
A sheet bend?
A sheet bend knot?
What's a sheet bend?
Because I've done what you said, but it wasn't a knot.
Spit, I am
Did
so
you bend
upset
over some
at
sheets?
You right now.
Did you bend over some sheets?
You don't want me to describe what I did.
All right. That's fair. You know what? I'm coming to think that if I'm going to be on this ship and this officer is also going to be on the ship. I don't know. There might not
look,
be.
Look. So this ship is quite large. It could hold 200 and them to them people. So, you know.
Edidum? 200 Edidum?
You heard the number I said. Don't question it. So, you know, we're able to go and post you somewhere where it won't be in a circumstance where your rope work will be in a compromised position. For example, we have the likes of Slam, who is shirtless all the time, but has no concept of anything
to do with the work that you're currently doing.
Shirts won't fit on the boy. You know, we've tried. He needs a special prescription shirt, and it's very far away where you have to pick it up.
Likewise, we have in the general, rigging of the ship, mm-hmm. Where obviously your knots will come in close quarters, coming quite handy. And there is no room up there for any of the concerns that you have, although I do suppose suspension play is a thing. Anyway.
Well, that actually brings me to an interesting point, because I would be open to being on this ship while Spit is also on this ship. But I would actually like to put it in my contract that I reserve the right to hoist myself up from roof scaffoldings at any point in time to get myself out of the way if Spit might be around. So if I were to be on this ship, just know that at any moment in time, I could be above you, just hanging out. It could be out of personal preference. It could be because I don't want to talk to you. But just know that no matter where you are on the ship, I could be right above you.
You could be.
I must say, I don't know. Suspension stuff is usually a hard limit for me, but now I'm thinking I'm reconcerned. Okay.
It is absolutely not sexual.
I'm open to some kind of enemies to lovers scenario, or enemies to enemies who fuck sometimes scenario, or some kind of scenario where we're enemies and then that tension simmers for a long time.
Enemies,
and we're
but there's only one
bed. Allies. And eventually it circles around to lovers at some point. I feel like that's an energy that we could sustain. I'm a yes. It's going to be a yes for me.
I'm so frustrated by this conversation. I'm going to lean right here against this woven guardrail that we have over a porthole next to wherever we're interviewing people, just out of frustration. And
Heal not. That's careful.
Yes.
Careful. Watch yourself now, all right?
I would be more than happy to have you constantly Mission Impossible.
So that's two yeses, Captain?
I do believe that this is a third yes.
All right, and what's the deal with this young man with peanut butter in his mouth?
He's great.
Donald holds up a thumb. All right. a unanimous yes? All right, well, I got to tell my wife and 8 kids that I am not coming home tonight because I'm hitting the skies.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Oh, no.
No. I've been looking for a reason to get out because life is just too boring. But this is great.
Oh, no.
What's this name of this ship again?
Okay.
Well, why don't we leave it to our young crew member who has just a mouthful of peanut butter to say the name of the ship. And then this game. All right.
Yep.
Scene. I do love that when Jonnet's not speaking, he's just like a full hand in a jar of peanut
butter. He's Winnie the Poohin'.
Campaign Skyjacks is a One-Shot Network production. For more information, be sure to follow us on Twitter over @CampaignPod for updates about live shows and other events we might be doing.
In the universe of Starwall Odyssey, space is made out of the collective imaginations of all the thinking beings who live on various planets. These worlds are connected to each other through imagination. Common themes and ideas are strings between universes. And to get between them, people fly wooden ships that look like animals, which are powered by emotions. Also, people communicate with each other by contemplating orbs. The only way you can take pictures is getting stared at by a big psychic bug. And people have already declared victory in a war over the very concept of evil. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Starwall Odyssey follows the adventures of the hapless inhabitants of the Lucky Finn tenement building, who suddenly find that their apartment is actually a spaceship, and that they're lost in a sea of boundless imagination. It's an actual play starring me, James D'Amato, Mel D'Amato, Ali Grauer, and Drew Merzieski, as we playtest the No King system, which will hopefully one day be the Skyjacks role-playing system. It toes the line between weird and wonderful slice of life and high-flying space fantasy. You can sample the first 5 episodes by searching for Star Wall Odyssey on your favorite podcast app, or get the whole thing by heading to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast and signing up for $5 a month or more. You can find more great gaming shows over at oneshotpodcast.com. Jonet Kessler was played by Tyler Davis, who can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Tyler A. Dave. You can stream his short film, Lining, on the Roku app. Gable was played by Liz Anderson, who can be found on Twitter at @LizAnderson_... or on her podcast, Paired. Travis Madigo was played by Johnny O'Mara, who can be found on Twitter at @JohnnyInBriefs or on his podcast, Bill Buds. Captain Oromar Vale was played by Nathan Blades, who can be found on Twitter at @PhantomArtsENT or streaming at twitch.tv/TheNeonCaster. I am James D'Amato, your host and game master. You can find me on Twitter at OneShotRPG or on my podcast, One Shot. The original music featured in this podcast was written, composed, and performed by Arnie Parrott. You can find him over on Twitter at Arnie Parrott or on his website, ATP Tunes. This episode was edited by Allie Grauer, who can be found on Twitter at Dreams to Become or on her podcast, Skyjack's Courier's Call. Our logo was designed by Fiona Shea, who can be found on Twitter at Lunarum. The World of Sphere was inspired in part by the music of the Decemberists and Illimat, produced by Together Studios. This show was made in part by using a modified version of the Genesis role-playing system, designed by Sam Stewart and a team of talented professionals. There are no kings. Take flight.
Health to the strangers who've ever been kind, and once for our friends ne'er to rise. Twice to the dearest we're leaving behind, who know we can never deny the call of the skies.